in attendance to wait upon us, but my mother wouldn't let her do it and made her dine with us. I had my own old plate, with a brown view of a man-o'-war in full sail upon it, which Peggotty had hoarded somewhere all the time I'd been away, and would not have had broken, she said, for £100. I had my own old mug with David on it, and my own old little knife and fork that wouldn't cut. While we were at the table, I thought it a favourable occasion to tell Peggotty about Mr. Barkis, who, before I'd finished what I had to tell her, began to laugh and threw her apron over her face. "Peggotty," said my mother, "what's the matter?" Peggotty only laughed the more, and held her apron tight over her face when my mother tried to pull it away, and sat as if her head were in a bag. "What are you doing, you stupid creature?" said my mother, laughing. "Oh, drat the man!" cried Peggotty. "He wants to marry me!" "It would be a very good match for you, wouldn't it?" said my mother. "Oh, I don't know," said Peggotty. "Don't ask me. I wouldn't have him if he was made of gold, nor I wouldn't have anybody." "Then why don't you tell him so, you ridiculous thing?" said my mother. "Tell him so?" retorted Peggotty, looking out of her apron. "He's never said a word to me about it. He knows better. If he was to make so bold as say a word to me, I should slap his face." Her own was as red as ever I saw it, or any other face, I think. But she only covered it again for a few moments at a time, when she was taken with a violent fit of laughter, and after two or three of those attacks went on with her dinner. I remarked that my mother, though she smiled when Peggotty looked at her, became more serious and thoughtful. I'd seen at first that she was changed. Her face was very pretty still, but it looked careworn and too delicate, and her hand was so thin and white that it seemed to me to be almost transparent. But the change to which I now refer was superadded to this. It was in her manner, which became anxious and fluttered. "At last," she said, putting out her hand and laying it affectionately on the hand of her old servant, "Peggotty, dear, you're not going to be married?"
"Me, ma'am?"
returned Peggotty, staring.
"Lord bless you, no!"
"Not just yet," said my mother tenderly.
"Never!" cried Peggotty.
My mother took her hand and said, "Don't leave me, Peggotty. Stay with me. It'll not be for long, perhaps. What should I ever do without you?"
"Me leave you, my precious?" cried Peggotty. "Not for all the world and his wife. Why, what's put that into your silly little head?"
For Peggotty had been used of old to talk to my mother sometimes like a child. My mother made no answer except to thank her, and Peggotty went running on in her own fashion.
"Me leave you? I think I see myself. Peggotty go away from you. I should like to catch her at it." "No, no, no," said Peggotty, shaking her head and folding her arms. "Not she, my dear. It isn't that there ain't some cats that would be well enough pleased if she did, but they shan't be pleased. They shall be aggravated. I'll stay with you till I'm a cross, cranky old woman, and when I'm too deaf and too lame and too blind and too mumbly for want of teeth to be of any use at all, even to be found fault with, then I shall go to my Davy and ask him to take me in. And Peggotty," says I shall be glad to see you, and I'll make you as welcome as a queen." "Bless your dear heart," cried Peggotty, "I know you will." And she kissed me beforehand in grateful acknowledgement of my hospitality.
After that she covered her head up with her apron again, and had another laugh about Mr. Barkis. After that she took the baby out of its little cradle and nursed it. After that she cleared the dinner table. After that came in with another cap on, and her workbox and the yard measure and the bit of wax candle, all just the same as ever. We sat round the fire and talked delightfully. I told them what a hard master Mr. Creakle was, and they pitied me very much. I told them what a fine fellow Steerforth was, and what a patron of mine, and Peggotty said she would walk a score of miles to see him. I took the little baby in my arms when it was awake and nursed it lovingly. When it was asleep again, I crept close to my mother's side according to our old custom, broken now a long time, and sat with my arms embracing her waist and my little red cheek on her shoulder, and once more felt her beautiful hair drooping over me, like an angel's wing, as I used to think I recollect, and was very happy indeed. While I sat thus, looking at the fire and seeing pictures in the red-hot coals, I almost believed that I'd never been away, that Mr. and Miss Murdstone were such pictures and would vanish when the fire got low, and that there was nothing real in all that I remembered save my mother, Peggotty, and I. Peggotty darned away at a stocking as long as she could see, and then sat with it drawn on her left hand like a glove, and her needle in her right, ready to take another stitch whenever there was a blaze. I cannot conceive whose stockings they can have been that Peggotty was always darning, or where such an unfailing supply of stockings in want of darning can have come from. From my earliest infancy she seems to have been always employed in that class of needlework, and never by any chance in any other.
"I wonder," said Peggotty, who was sometimes seized with a fit of wondering on some most unexpected topic, "what's become of Davy's great-aunt?"
"Lord Peggotty," observed my mother, rousing herself from a reverie, "what nonsense you talk!"
"Well, but I really do wonder, ma'am," said Peggotty.
"What can have put such a person in your head?" inquired my mother. "Is there nobody else in the world to come there?"
"I don't know how it is," said Peggotty, "unless it's on account of being stupid, but my head can never pick and choose its people. They come and they go, and they don't come and they don't go, just as they like. I wonder what's become of her."
"How absurd you are, Peggotty," returned my mother. "One would suppose you wanted a second visit from her."
"Lord forbid," cried Peggotty.
"Well, then, don't talk about such uncomfortable things, there's a good soul," said my mother. "Miss Betsy is shut up in her cottage by the sea, no doubt, and will remain there. At all events, she's not likely ever to trouble us again."
"No," mused Peggotty. "No, that ain't likely at all. I wonder if she was to die, whether she'd leave Davy anything."
"Good gracious me, Peggotty," returned my mother. "What a nonsensical woman you are, when you know that she took offence at the poor dear boy's ever being born at all."
"I suppose she wouldn't be inclined to forgive him now,"
hinted Peggotty.
"Why should she be inclined to forgive him now?" said my mother rather sharply.
"Now that he's got a brother, I mean," said Peggotty. My mother immediately began to cry and wondered how Peggotty dared to say such a thing. "As if this poor little innocent in its cradle had ever done any harm to you or anybody else, you jealous thing," said she. "You'd much better go and marry Mr. Barkis the carrier. Why don't you?"
"I should make Miss Murdstone happy if I was to," said Peggotty.
"What a bad disposition you have, Peggotty," returned my mother. "You're as jealous of Miss Murdstone as it's possible for a ridiculous creature to be. You want to keep the keys yourself and give out all the things, I suppose. I shouldn't be surprised if you did, when you know that she only does it out of kindness and the best intentions. You know she does, Peggotty, you know it well."
Peggotty muttered something to the effect of "bother the best intentions," and something else to the effect that there was a little too much of the best intentions going on.
"I know what you mean, you cross thing," said my mother. "I understand you, Peggotty, perfectly. You know I do, and I wonder you don't colour up like fire. But one point at a time. Miss Murdstone is the point now, Peggotty, and you shan't escape from it. Haven't you heard her say over and over again that she thinks I'm too thoughtless and too, pretty?" suggested Peggotty.
"Well," returned my mother, half laughing, "then if she is so silly as to say so, can I be blamed for it?"
"No one says you can," said Peggotty.
"No, I should hope not, indeed," returned my mother. "Haven't you heard her say over and over again that on this account she wishes to spare me a great deal of trouble which she thinks I'm not suited for, and which I really don't know myself that I am suited for? And isn't she up early and late and going to and fro continually? And doesn't she do all sorts of things and grope into all sorts of places, coal holes and pantries and I don't know where, that can't be very agreeable? And do you mean to insinuate that there's not a sort of devotion in that?
I don't insinuate at all, said Peggotty.
You do, Peggotty, returned my mother. You never do anything else except your work. You're always insinuating. You revel in it. When you talk of Mr. Murdstone's good intentions, I never talked of them, said Peggotty. No, Peggotty, returned my mother, but you insinuated. That's what I told you just now. That's the worst of you. You will insinuate. I said at the moment that I understood you, and you see I did. When you talk of Mr. Murdstone's good intentions and pretend to slight them, for I don't believe you really do in your heart, Peggotty, you must be as well convinced as I am how good they are and how they actuate him in everything. If he seems to have been at all stern with a certain person, Peggotty, you understand, and so I'm sure does Davy, that I'm not alluding to anybody present, it is solely because he is satisfied that it is for a certain person's benefit. He naturally loves a certain person on my account, and acts solely for a certain person's good. He's better able to judge of it than I am, for I very well know that I am a weak, light, girlish creature, and that he is a firm, grave, serious man, and
he takes,
said my mother, with the tears which were engendered in her affectionate nature stealing down her face,
he takes great pains with me, and I ought to be very thankful to him and very submissive to him, even in my thoughts. And when I'm not, Peggotty, I worry and condemn myself, and feel doubtful of my own heart, and don't know what to do.
Peggotty sat with her chin on the foot of the stocking, looking silently at the fire. There, Peggotty, said my mother, changing her tone, don't let us fall out with one another, for I couldn't bear it. You're my true friend, I know, if I have any in the world. When I call you a ridiculous creature or a vexatious thing or anything of that sort, Peggotty, I only mean that you are my true friend and always have been, ever since the night when Mr. Copperfield first brought me home here and you came out to the gate to meet me. Peggotty was not slow to respond, and ratified the treaty of friendship by giving me one of her best hugs. I think I had some glimpses of the real character of this conversation at the time, but I'm sure now that the good creature originated it and took her part in it merely that my mother might comfort herself with the little contradictory summary in which she'd indulged. The design was efficacious, for I remember that my mother seemed more at ease during the rest of the evening, and that Peggotty observed her less. When we had our tea, and the ashes were thrown up and the candles snuffed, I read Peggotty a chapter out of the crocodile book in remembrance of old times. She took it out of her pocket, I don't know whether she'd kept it there ever since. And then we talked about Salem House, which brought me round again to Steerforth, who was my great subject. We were very happy. And that evening, as the last of its race, and destined evermore to close that volume of my life, will never pass out of my memory. It was almost 10 o'clock before we heard the sound of wheels. We all got up then, and my mother said hurriedly that, as it was so late and Mr. and Miss Murdstone approved of early hours for young people, perhaps I'd better go to bed. I kissed her, and went upstairs with my candle directly before they came in. It appeared to my childish fancy, as I ascended to the bedroom where I'd been imprisoned, that they brought a cold blast of air into the house which blew away the old familiar feeling like a feather. I felt uncomfortable about going down to breakfast in the morning, as I'd never set eyes on Mr. Murdstone since the day when I committed my memorable offence. However, as it must be done, I went down after 2 or 3 false starts halfway, and as many runs back on tiptoe to my own room, and presented myself in the parlour. He was standing before the fire with his back to it, while Miss Murdstone made the tea. He looked at me steadily as I entered, but made no sign of recognition whatever. I went up to him after a moment of confusion and said, I beg your pardon, sir.
I'm very sorry for what I did, and I hope you will forgive me.
I'm glad to hear you're sorry, David, he replied.
The hand he gave me was the hand I had bitten. I couldn't restrain my eye from resting for an instant on a red spot upon it, but it was not so red as I turned when I met that sinister expression in his face. How do you do, ma'am? I said to Miss Murdstone.
Ah, dear me,
sighed Miss Murdstone, giving me the tea caddy scoop instead of her fingers.
How long are the holidays?
A month, ma'am.
Counting from when?
From today, ma'am.
Ah, said Miss Murdstone, then here's one day off.
She kept a calendar of the holidays in this way, and every morning checked a day off in exactly the same manner. She did it gloomily until she came to 10, but when she got into 2 figures she became more hopeful, and, as the time advanced, even jocular. It was on this very first day that I had the misfortune to throw her, though she was not subject to such weaknesses in general, into a state of violent consternation. I came into the room where she and my mother were sitting, and the baby, who was only a few weeks old, being on my mother's lap, I took it very carefully in my arms. Suddenly Miss Murdstone gave such a scream that I all but dropped it.
My dear Jane!
Cried my mother.
Good heavens, Clara, you see, exclaimed Miss Murdstone.
See what, my dear Jane, said my mother.
Where? He's got it, cried Miss Murdstone. The boy has got the baby.
She was limp with horror, but stiffened herself to make a dart at me and take it out of my arms. Then she turned faint and was so ill that they were obliged to give her cherry brandy. I was solemnly interdicted by her on her recovery from touching my brother any more, on any pretence whatever, and my poor mother, who I could see wished otherwise, meekly confirmed the interdict by saying, "No doubt you're right, my dear Jane." On another occasion, when we three were together, this same dear baby, it was truly dear to me for our mother's sake, was the innocent occasion of Miss Murdstone's going into a passion. My mother, who had been looking at its eyes as it lay upon her lap, said, "Davy, come here," and looked at mine. I saw Miss Murdstone lay her beads down.
"I declare," said my mother gently, "they are exactly alike. I suppose they're mine. I think they're the colour of mine, but they are wonderfully alike."
"What are you talking about, Clara?" said Miss Murdstone. My dear Jane," faltered my mother, a little abashed by the harsh tone of this inquiry, "I find that the baby's eyes and Davy's are exactly alike."
"Clara," said Miss Murdstone, rising angrily, "you are a positive fool sometimes."
"My dear Jane," remonstrated my mother. "A positive fool," said Miss Murdstone. "Who else could compare my brother's baby with your boy? They are not at all alike. They are exactly unlike. They are utterly dissimilar in all respects. I hope they will ever remain so. I will not sit here and hear such comparisons made." With that, she stalked out and made the door bang after her. In short, I wasn't a favourite with Miss Murdstone. In short, I wasn't a favourite there with anybody, not even with myself. For those who did like me couldn't show it, and those who did not showed it so plainly that I had a sensitive consciousness of always appearing constrained, boorish, and dull. I felt that I made them as uncomfortable as they made me. If I came into the room where they were, and they were talking together, and my mother seemed cheerful, an anxious cloud would steal over her face from the moment of my entrance. If Mr. Murdstone were in his best humour, I checked him. If Miss Murdstone were in her worst, I intensified it. I had perception enough to know that my mother was the victim always, that she was afraid to speak to me or be kind to me, lest she should give them some offence by her manner of doing so and receive a lecture afterwards. That she was not only ceaselessly afraid of her own offending, but of my offending, and uneasily watched their looks if I only moved. Therefore I resolved to keep myself as much out of their way as I could. And many a wintry hour did I hear the church clock strike when I was sitting in my cheerless bedroom, wrapped in my little greatcoat, poring over a book. In the evening sometimes I went and sat with Peggotty in the kitchen. There I was comfortable and not afraid of being myself. But neither of these resources was approved of in the parlour. The tormenting humour which was dominant there stopped them both. I was still held to be necessary to my poor mother's training, and as one of her trials could not be suffered to absent myself. "David," said Mr. Murdstone, one day after dinner when I was going to leave the room as usual, "I'm sorry to observe that you are of a sullen disposition." "As sulky as a bear," said Miss Murdstone. I stood still and hung my head. "Now, David," said Mr. Murdstone, "a sullen, obdurate disposition is, of all tempers, the worst. And the boy's is, of all such dispositions that ever I have seen," remarked his sister, "the most confirmed and stubborn. I think, my dear Clara, even you must observe it." "I beg your pardon, my dear Jane," said my mother, "but you're quite sure... I'm certain you'll excuse me, my dear Jane, that you understand, Davy." "I should be somewhat ashamed of myself, Clara," returned Miss Murdstone, "if I could not understand the boy, or any boy. I don't profess to be profound, but I do lay claim to common sense." "No doubt, my dear Jane," returned my mother, "your understanding is very vigorous." "Oh, dear, no, pray don't say that, Clara," interposed Miss Murdstone angrily. "But I'm sure it is," resumed my mother, "and everybody knows it is. I profit so much by it myself in many ways, at least I ought to, that no one can be more convinced of it than myself, and therefore I speak with great diffidence, my dear Jane, I assure you." "We'll say I don't understand the boy, Clara," returned Miss Murdstone, arranging the little fetters on her wrists. "We'll agree, if you please, that I don't understand him at all. He is much too deep for me. But perhaps my brother's penetration may enable him to have some insight into his character. And I believe my brother was speaking on the subject when we, not very decently, interrupted him." "I think, Clara," said Mr. Murdstone in a low, grave voice, "that there may be better and more dispassionate judges of such a question than you." "Edward," replied my mother timidly, "you are a far better judge of all questions than I pretend to be. Both you and Jane are. I only said..." "You only said something weak and inconsiderate," he replied. "Try not to do it again, my dear Clara, and keep a watch upon yourself." My mother's lips moved, as if she answered, "Yes, my dear Edward," but she said nothing aloud. "I was sorry, David," I remarked, said Mr. Murdstone, turning his head and his eyes stiffly towards me, "to observe that you are of a sullen disposition. This is not a character that I can suffer to develop itself beneath my eyes without an effort at improvement. You must endeavour, sir, to change it. We must endeavour to change it for you." "I beg your pardon, sir," I faltered. "I've never meant to be sullen since I came back." "Don't take refuge in a lie, sir," he returned so fiercely that I saw my mother involuntarily put out her trembling hand as if to interpose between us. "You have withdrawn yourself in your sullenness to your own room. You have kept your own room when you ought to have been here. You know now once for all that I require you to be here and not there. Further, that I require you to bring obedience here. You know me, David. I will have it done." Miss Murdstone gave a hoarse chuckle. "I will have a respectful, prompt, and ready bearing towards myself," he continued, "and towards Jane Murdstone, and towards your mother. I will not have this room shunned as if it were infected at the pleasure of a child. Sit down." He ordered me like a dog, and I obeyed like a dog. "One thing more," he said. "I observe that you have an attachment to low and common company. You are not to associate with servants. The kitchen will not improve you in the many respects in which you need improvement. Of the woman who abets you, I say nothing. Since you, Clara," addressing my mother in a lower voice, "from old associations and long-established fancies, have a weakness respecting her which is not yet overcome." "A most unaccountable delusion it is," cried Miss Murdstone. "I only say," he resumed, addressing me, "that I disapprove of your preferring such company as Mistress Peggotty, and that it is to be abandoned. Now, David, you understand me, and you know what will be the consequence if you fail to obey me to the letter." I knew well, better perhaps than he thought, as far as my poor mother was concerned, and I obeyed him to the letter. I retreated to my own room no more. I took refuge with Peggotty no more, but sat wearily in the parlour day after day, looking forward to night and bedtime. What irksome constraint I underwent, sitting in the same attitude, hours upon hours, afraid to move an arm or a leg, lest Miss Murdstone should complain, as she did, on the least pretence, of my restlessness, and afraid to move an eye, lest it should light on some look of dislike or scrutiny that would find new cause for complaint in mine. What intolerable dullness to sit listening to the ticking of the clock, and watching Miss Murdstone's little shiny steel beads as she strung them, and wondering whether she would ever be married, and if so, to what sort of unhappy man, and counting the divisions in the moulding on the chimney-piece, and wandering away with my eyes to the ceiling among the curls and corkscrews in the paper on the wall. What walks I took alone down muddy lanes in the bad winter weather, carrying that parlour, and Mr. and Miss Murdstone in it everywhere. A monstrous load that I was obliged to bear, a daymare that there was no possibility of breaking, and a weight that brooded on my wits and blunted them. What meals I had in silence and embarrassment, always feeling that there were a knife and fork too many and that mine, an appetite too many and that mine, a plate and chair too many and those mine, a somebody too many and that I. What evenings, when the candles came and I was expected to employ myself, but not daring to read an entertaining book, pored over some hard-headed, harder-hearted treatise on arithmetic, when the tables of weights and measures set themselves to tunes as Rule Britannia or Away with Melancholy, and wouldn't stand still to be learnt, but would go threading my grandmother's needle through my unfortunate head, in at one ear and out at the other. What yawns and dozes I lapsed into, in spite of all my care! What starts I came out of concealed sleeps with! What answers I never got to little observations that I rarely made! What a blank space I seemed, which everybody overlooked and yet was in everybody's way! What a heavy relief it was to hear Miss Murdstone hail the first stroke of 9 at night and order me to bed! Thus the holidays lagged away, until the morning came when Miss Murdstone said, "Here's the last day off," and gave me the closing cup of tea of the vacation. I wasn't sorry to go. I'd lapsed into a stupid state. But I was recovering a little and looking forward to Steerforth, albeit Mr. Creakle loomed behind him. Again Mr. Barkis appeared at the gate, and again Miss Murdstone, in her warning voice, had cleared up when my mother bent over me to bid me farewell. I kissed her, and my baby brother, and was very sorry then, but not sorry to go away, for the gulf between us was there, and the parting was there every day. And it's not so much the embrace she gave me that lives in my mind, though it was as fervent as could be, as what followed the embrace. I was in the carrier's cart when I heard her calling to me. I looked out, and she stood at the garden gate alone, holding her baby up in her arms for me to see. It was cold, still weather, and not a hair of her head or a fold of her dress was stirred as she looked intently at me, holding up her child. So I lost her. So I saw her afterwards, in my sleep at school. A silent presence near my bed, looking at me with the same intent face, holding up her baby in her arms.
This ends side 2 of cassette 4 of David Copperfield. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 5. David Copperfield, Cassette 5.
Chapter 9. I Have a Memorable Birthday. I pass over all that happened at school until the anniversary of my birthday came round in March. Except that Steerforth was more to be admired than ever, I remember nothing. He was going away at the end of the half year, if not sooner, and was more spirited and independent than before in my eyes, and therefore more engaging than before. But beyond this, I remember nothing. The great remembrance by which that time is marked in my mind seems to have swallowed up all lesser recollections and to exist alone. It's even difficult for me to believe that there was a gap of full 2 months between my return to Salem House and the arrival of that birthday. I can only understand that the fact was so, because I know it must have been so. Otherwise I should feel convinced that there was no interval, and that the one occasion trod upon the other's heels. How well I recollect the kind of day it was. I smell the fog that hung about the place. I see the hoar frost ghostly through it. I feel my rimy hair fall clammy on my cheek. I look along the dim perspective of the schoolroom with a sputtering candle here and there to light up the foggy morning, and the breath of the boys wreathing and smoking in the raw cold as they blow upon their fingers and tap their feet upon the floor. It was after breakfast, and we'd been summoned in from the playground, when Mr. Sharp entered and said, "David Copperfield is to go into the parlour." I expected a hamper from Peggotty, and brightened at the order. Some of the boys about me put in their claim not to be forgotten in the distribution of the good things, as I got out of my seat with great alacrity. "Don't hurry, David," said Mr. Sharp. "There's time enough, my boy. Don't hurry." I might have been surprised by the feeling tone in which he spoke if I'd given it a thought, but I gave it none until afterwards. I hurried away to the parlour, and there I found Mr. Creakle sitting at his breakfast with the cane and a newspaper before him, and Mrs. Creakle with an opened letter in her hand, but no hamper. "David Copperfield," said Mrs. Creakle, leading me to a sofa and sitting down beside me, "I want to speak to you very particularly. I have something to tell you, my child." Mr. Creakle, at whom, of course, I looked, shook his head without looking at me, and stopped up a sigh with a very large piece of buttered toast. "You are too young to know how the world changes every day," said Mrs. Creakle, "and how the people in it pass away. But we all have to learn it, David. Some of us when we are young, some of us when we're old, some of us at all times of our lives." I looked at her earnestly. "When you came away from home at the end of the vacation," said Mrs. Creakle after a pause, "were they all well?" After another pause, "was your mamma well?" I trembled without distinctly knowing why, and still looked at her earnestly, making no attempt to answer. "Because," said she, "I grieve to tell you that I hear this morning your mamma is very ill." A mist arose between Mrs. Creakle and me, and her figure seemed to move in it for an instant. Then I felt the burning tears run down my face, and it was steady again. "She is very dangerously ill," she added. I knew all now. "She is dead." There was no need to tell me so. I had already broken out into a desolate cry and felt an orphan in the wide world. She was very kind to me. She kept me there all day and left me alone sometimes, and I cried and wore myself to sleep and awoke and cried again. When I could cry no more, I began to think. And then the oppression on my breast was heaviest, and my grief a dull pain that there was no ease for. And yet my thoughts were idle, not intent on the calamity that weighed upon my heart, but idly loitering near it. I thought of our house shut up and hushed. I thought of the little baby who, Mrs. Creakle said, had been pining away for some time, and who they believed would die too. I thought of my father's grave in the churchyard by our house, and of my mother lying there beneath the tree I knew so well. I stood upon a chair when I was left alone, and looked into the glass to see how red my eyes were, and how sorrowful my face. I considered, after some hours were gone, if my tears were really hard to flow now, as they seemed to be, what, in connection with my loss, it would affect me most to think of when I drew near home. For I was going home to the funeral. I'm sensible of having felt that a dignity attached to me among the rest of the boys, and that I was important in my affliction. If ever child was stricken with sincere grief, I was. But I remember that this importance was a kind of satisfaction to me when I walked in the playground that afternoon while the boys were in school. When I saw them glancing at me out of the windows as they went up to their classes, I felt distinguished, and looked more melancholy, and walked slower. When school was over, and they came out and spoke to me, I felt it rather good in myself, not to be proud to any of them, and to take exactly the same notice of them all as before. I was to go home next night, not by the mail, but by the heavy night coach which was called the Farmer, and was principally used by country people travelling short, intermediate distances upon the road. We had no storytelling that evening, and Traddles insisted on lending me his pillow. I don't know what good he thought it would do me, for I had one of my own, but it was all he had to lend, poor fellow, except a sheet of letter paper full of skeletons. And that he gave me at parting as a soother of my sorrows and a contribution to my peace of mind. I left Salem House upon the morrow afternoon. I little thought then that I left it never to return. We travelled very slowly all night and didn't get into Yarmouth before 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning. I looked out for Mr. Barkis, but he wasn't there. And instead of him, a fat, short-winded, merry-looking little old man in black, with rusty little bunches of ribbons at the knees of his breeches, black stockings and a broad-brimmed hat, came puffing up to the coach window and said, "Master Copperfield?" "Yes, sir." "Would you come with me, young sir, if you please?" he said, opening the door, "and I shall have the pleasure of taking you home." I put my hand in his, wondering who he was, and we walked away to a shop in a narrow street on which was written Omer, Draper, Tailor, Haberdasher, Funeral Furnisher, etc. It was a close and stifling little shop, full of all sorts of clothing, made and unmade, including one window full of beaver hats and bonnets. We went into a little back parlour behind the shop, where we found 3 young women at work on a quantity of black materials which were heaped upon the table, and little bits and cuttings of which were littered all over the floor. There was a good fire in the room, and a breathless smell of warm black crepe. I didn't know what the smell was then, but I know now. The 3 young women, who appeared to be very industrious and comfortable, raised their heads to look at me, and then went on with their work,
stitch, stitch, stitch. At the same time there came from a workshop across a little yard outside the window a regular sound of hammering that kept a kind of tune. Rat, ta-tat, rat, ta-tat, rat, ta-tat, without any variation. Well, said my conductor to one of the three young women, how do you get on, Minnie? We shall be ready by the trying on time, she replied gaily without looking up. Don't you be afraid, father. Mr. Omer took off his broad-brimmed hat and sat down and panted. He was so fat that he was obliged to pant some time before he could say, that's right. Father, said Minnie playfully, what a porpoise you do grow. Well, I don't know how it is, my dear, he replied, considering about it. I am rather so. You're such a comfortable man, you see, said Minnie. You take things so easy. No use taking them otherwise, my dear, said Mr. Omer. No, indeed, returned his daughter. We're all pretty gay here, thank heaven, ain't we, father? I hope so, my dear, said Mr. Omer. As I've got my breath now, I think I'll measure this young scholar. Would you walk into the shop, Master Copperfield? I preceded Mr. Omer in compliance with his request, and after showing me a roll of cloth which he said was extra, super, and too good morning for anything short of parents, he took my various dimensions and put them down in a book. While he was recording them, he called my attention to his stock in trade and to certain fashions which he said had just come up, and to certain other fashions which he said had just gone out. And by that sort of thing we very often lose a little mint of money, said Mr. Omer, but fashions are like human beings. They come in, nobody knows when, why, or how, and they go out, nobody knows when, why, or how. Everything is like life, in my opinion, if you look at it in that point of view. I was too sorrowful to discuss the question, which would possibly have been beyond me under any circumstances, and Mr. Omer took me back into the parlour, breathing with some difficulty on the way. He then called down a little breakneck range of steps behind a door, "Bring up that tea and bread and butter!" Which, after some time, during which I sat looking about me and thinking, and listening to the stitching in the room, and the tune that was being hammered across the yard, appeared on a tray, and turned out to be for me. "I've been acquainted with you," said Mr. Omer, after watching me for some minutes, during which I had not made much impression on the breakfast, for the black things destroyed my appetite. "I've been acquainted with you a long time, my young friend." "Have you, sir?" "All your life," said Mr. Omer. "I may say before it. I knew your father before you. He was 5'9½" and he lies in 5 20 foot of ground. Rat, ta-tat, rat, ta-tat, rat, ta-tat, across the yard. He lies in 5 20 foot of ground if he lays in a fraction, said Mr. Omer pleasantly. It was either his request or her direction, I forget which. Do you know how my little brother is, sir? I inquired. Mr. Omer shook his head. Rat, ta-tat, tat, rat, ta-tat, rat, ta-tat. He's in his mother's arms, said he. Oh, poor little fellow, is he dead? Don't mind it more than you can help, said Mr. Omer. Yes, the baby's dead. My wounds broke out afresh at this intelligence. I left the scarcely tasted breakfast and went and rested my head on another table in a corner of the little room, which Minnie hastily cleared, lest I should spot the morning that was lying there with my tears. She was a pretty, good-natured girl, and put my hair away from my eyes with a soft, kind touch. But she was very cheerful at having nearly finished her work and being in good time, and was so different from me. Presently the tune left off, and a good-looking young fellow came across the yard into the room. He had a hammer in his hand, and his mouth was full of little nails, which he was obliged to take out before he could speak. "Well, Joram," said Mr. Omer, "how do you get on?" "All right," said Joram. "Done, sir." Minnie coloured a little, and the other two girls smiled at one another. "What? You were at it by candlelight last night when I was at the club, then, were you?"
said Mr. Homer, shutting up one eye. Yes, said Shoreham. As you said, we could make a little trip of it and go over together if it was done, Minnie and me. And you. Oh! I thought you were going to leave me out altogether, said Mr. Homer, laughing till he coughed. As you was so good as to say that, resumed the young man, why, I turned to it with a will, you see. Will you give me your opinion of it? I will, said Mr. Homer, rising. My dear, and he stopped and turned to me, would you like to see your... No, father, Minnie interposed. I thought it might be agreeable, my dear, said Mr. Homer, but perhaps you're right. I can't say how I knew it was my dear, dear mother's coffin that they went to look at. I'd never heard one making. I'd never seen one that I know of. But it came into my mind what the noise was while it was going on, and when the young man entered, I'm sure I knew what he'd been doing. The work being now finished, the two girls, whose names I'd not heard, brushed the shreds and threads from their dresses and went into the shop to put that to rights and wait for customers. Minnie stayed behind to fold up what they'd made and pack it in two baskets. This she did upon her knees, humming a lively little tune the while. Joram, who I had no doubt was her lover, came in and stole a kiss from her while she was busy. He didn't appear to mind me at all, and said her father was gone for the chaise, and he must make haste and get himself ready. Then he went out again, and then she put her thimble and scissors in her pocket and stuck a needle threaded with black thread neatly in the bosom of her gown, and put on her outer clothing smartly at a little glass behind the door, in which I saw the reflection of her pleased face. All this I observed sitting at the table in the corner with my head leaning on my hand, and my thoughts running on very different things. The chaise soon came round to the front of the shop, and the baskets being put in first, I was put in next, and those three followed. I remember it as a kind of half chaise cart, half pianoforte van, painted of a sombre colour, and drawn by a black horse with a long tail. There was plenty of room for us all. I don't think I've ever experienced so strange a feeling in my life. I'm wiser now, perhaps, as that of being with them, remembering how they'd been employed, and seeing them enjoy the ride. I wasn't angry with them. I was more afraid of them, as if I were cast away among creatures with whom I had no community of nature. They were very cheerful. The old man sat in front to drive, and the two young people sat behind him, and whenever he spoke to them, leaned forward, the one on one side of his chubby face and the other on the other, and made a great deal of him. They would have talked to me too, but I held back and moped in my corner, scared by their love-making and hilarity, though it was far from boisterous, and almost wondering that no judgment came upon them for their hardness of heart. So, when they stopped to bait the horse, and ate and drank and enjoyed themselves, I could touch nothing that they touched, but kept my fast unbroken. So when we reached home, I dropped out of the chaise behind as quickly as possible, that I mightn't be in their company before those solemn windows looking blindly on me like closed eyes once bright. And oh, how little need I'd had to think what would move me to tears when I came back. Seeing the window of my mother's room, and next it that which, in the better time, was mine. I was in Peggotty's arms before I got to the door, and she took me into the house. Her grief burst out when she first saw me, but she controlled it soon, and spoke in whispers, and walked softly, as if the dead could be disturbed. She'd not been in bed, I found, for a long time. She sat up at night still and watched. As long as her poor dear pretty was above the ground, she said she would never desert her. Mr. Murdstone took no heed of me when I went into the parlour where he was, but sat by the fireside, weeping silently and pondering in his elbow chair. Miss Murdstone, who was busy at her writing desk, which was covered with letters and papers, gave me her cold fingernails and asked me in an iron whisper if I had been measured for my mourning. I said yes. "And your shirts?" said Miss Murdstone. "Have you brought them home?"
"Yes, Mum. I brought home all my clothes."
This was all the consolation that her firmness administered to me. I do not doubt that she had a choice pleasure in exhibiting what she called her self-command and her firmness and her strength of mind and her common sense, and the whole diabolical catalogue of her unamiable qualities on such an occasion. She was particularly proud of her turn for business, and she showed it now in reducing everything to pen and ink and being moved by nothing. All the rest of that day, and from morning to night afterwards, she sat at that desk, scratching composedly with a hard pen, speaking in the same imperturbable whisper to everybody, never relaxing a muscle of her face or softening a tone of her voice or appearing with an atom of her dress astray. Her brother took a book sometimes, but never read it that I saw. He would open it and look at it as if he were reading, but would remain for a whole hour without turning the leaf, and then put it down and walk to and fro in the room. I used to sit with folded hands watching him and counting his footsteps, hour after hour. He very seldom spoke to her, and never to me. He seemed to be the only restless thing except the clocks in the whole motionless house. In these days before the funeral, I saw but little of Peggotty, except that in passing up or downstairs, I always found her close to the room where my mother and her baby lay, and except that she came to me every night and sat by my bed's head while I went to sleep. A day or two before the burial, I think it was a day or two before, but I'm conscious of confusion in my mind about that heavy time, with nothing to mark its progress, she took me into the room. I only recollect that underneath some white covering on the bed, with a beautiful cleanliness and freshness all around it, there seemed to me to lie embodied the solemn stillness that was in the house. And that when she would have turned the cover gently back, I cried, "Oh, no! Oh, no!" and held her hand. If the funeral had been yesterday, I couldn't recollect it better. The very air of the best parlour when I went in at the door, the bright condition of the fire, the shining of the wine in the decanters, the patterns of the glasses and plates, the faint, sweet smell of cake, the odour of Miss Murdstone's dress, and our black clothes. Mr. Chillip is in the room, and comes to speak to me. "And how is Master David?" he says kindly. I cannot tell him very well. I give him my hand, which he holds in his. "Dear me," says Mr. Chillip, meekly smiling with something shining in his eye, "our little friends grow up around us. They grow out of our knowledge, ma'am." This to Miss Murdstone, who makes no reply. "There is a great improvement here, ma'am," says Mr. Chillip. Miss Murdstone merely answers with a frown and a formal bend. Mr. Chillip, discomfited, goes into a corner, keeping me with him, and opens his mouth no more. I remark this because I remark everything that happens, not because I care about myself, or have done since I came home. And now the bell begins to sound, and Mr. Omer and another come to make us ready. As Peggotty was wont to tell me long ago, the followers of my father to the same grave were made ready in the same room. There are Mr. Murdstone, our neighbour Mr. Graper, Mr. Chillip, and I. When we go out to the door, the bearers and their load are in the garden, and they move before us down the path, and past the elms, and through the gate, and into the churchyard where I have so often heard the birds sing on a summer morning. We stand around the grave. The day seems different to me from every other day, and the light not of the same colour, of a sadder colour. Now there's a solemn hush, which we have brought from home with what is resting in the mould. and while we stand bareheaded, I hear the voice of the clergyman sounding remote in the open air, and yet distinct and plain, saying, I am the resurrection and the life, saith the Lord. Then I hear sobs, and standing apart among the lookers-on, I see that good and faithful servant, whom of all the people upon earth I love the best, and unto whom my childish heart is certain that the Lord will one day say, Well done. There are many faces that I know among the little crowd, faces that I knew in church when mine was always wandering there, faces that first saw my mother when she came to the village in her youthful bloom. I do not mind them. I mind nothing but my grief. And yet I see and know them all. And even in the background, far away, see Minnie looking on, and her eye glancing on her sweetheart, who is near me. It is over, and the earth is filled in, and we turn to come away. Before us stands our house, so pretty and unchanged, so linked in my mind with the young idea of what is gone, that all my sorrow has been nothing to the sorrow it calls forth. But they take me on, and Mr. Chillip talks to me, and when we get home puts some water to my lips. And when I ask his leave to go up to my room, dismisses me with the gentleness of a woman. All this, I say, is yesterday's event. Events of later date have floated from me to the shore where all forgotten things will reappear, but this stands like a high rock in the ocean. I knew that Peggotty would come to me in my room. The Sabbath stillness of the time, the day was so like Sunday, I've forgotten that, was suited to us both. She sat down by my side upon my little bed, and holding my hand, and sometimes putting it to her lips, and sometimes smoothing it with hers, as she might have comforted my little brother, told me in her way all that she had to tell concerning what had happened. She was never well, said Peggotty, for a long time. She was uncertain in her mind and not happy. When her baby was born, I thought at first she would get better. But she was more delicate and sunk a little every day. She used to like to sit alone before her baby came, and then she cried. But afterwards she used to sing to it, so soft that I once thought when I heard her, it was like a voice up in the air that was rising away. I think she got to be more timid and more frightened like of late, and that a hard word was like a blow to her. But she was always the same to me. She never changed to her foolish Peggotty, didn't my sweet girl? Here Peggotty stopped and softly beat upon my hand a little while. The last time that I saw her like her own old self was the night when you came home, my dear. The day you went away, she said to me, I never shall see my pretty darling again. Something tells me so that tells the truth, I know. She tried to hold up after that, and many a time when they told her she was thoughtless and light-hearted, made believe to be so, but it was all a bygone then. She never told her husband what she'd told me. She was afraid of saying it to anybody else, till one night, a little more than a week before it happened, when she said to him, My dear, I think I'm dying. It's off my mind now, Peggotty, she told me, when I laid her in her bed that night. He'll believe it more and more, poor fellow, every day for a few days to come, and then it'll be past. I'm very tired. If this is sleep, sit by me while I sleep. Don't leave me.